stance. The dice roll every random chance. Take off your coat and stay a while. We'll roll in that D percentile.
All right, got a couple of episodes queued up. So by the time this goes out, I'll have played the game that I'm referring to. But I'm getting excited prepping for this evening my sci-fi setting Electric Bastion Land game. Putting Electric Bastion Land on hold for a bit because I'm building up for Old School Essentials. I'm running, well, I have been till very recently running three games at once. I've wound down the Numenera game, and I've announced that tonight is going to be the last Electric Bastion Land for a while, and then eventually my Dark Sun will wind down and I'll just be focusing on Old School Essentials. But what I've decided, I've told the players, did a general call, anyone who wants to get involved, it's going to be a high stakes, high fatality session tonight. I've been running it in my sci-fi setting. I haven't really done an extended podcast about this, but one of the things is I found sci-fi really difficult to run. I went for a setting that was just sort of drawing on bits of Warhammer 40,000, Borderlands, some of my favourite movies, Aliens, Pitch Black. So, well, you know, you'd think that was all pretty familiar, but just the I'm constantly reminded about how useful it is playing in medieval fantasy when you can assume so much of a shared understanding. You know, people keep asking me things like, okay, so how do we communicate with each other? You know, I want to call them up. What are we using? What kind of device are we using? I'm like, oh, I haven't thought of that. Just constantly having to think things through. The sci-fi I'm not finding as natural to improvise as other settings. But yeah, I'm looking forward to tonight. I'm basically going to test out all of those other rules that are in the book for just scaling things up. So I've already said it's my own sci-fi setting, but I'm using the rules as written. But there are rules in there for mechs, vehicles, detachments, you know, larger scale combat. So I'm going to do all of that. We're going to have detachments in there. So I'm going to have challenges there, which the characters will only be able to face if they find themselves some big vehicles or find themselves some squads of people to drag into combat. So we're going to have detachments in there. I'm going to have gangs roving about the place. We're going to have vehicles in there. We're going to have some big frenzied Xenos that I'm going to treat as detachments in themselves. They're going to use the detachment rules because they're so big. So unless the players are using... It is a beautiful day out here. I'm sat out in the garden. It is such lovely weather. We've had a run of really beautiful summer weather. Yeah, but big creatures, unless the players are using blast weapons or appropriate weapons, they're just going to be impaired against them. And these creatures, unless the players are in detachments, the characters are going to do additional damage to them. And then, yeah, I'm going to use the sort of mech rules as well. So there'll be powered armour in there as well. I've decided for the setting, yeah, they're going to be sent to a... they're always looking for an artifact, some kind of valuable artifact. So here it will be a valuable artifact that's required some kind of meltdown to be created. And they'll be picking it up from some radiation-scarred catastrophe site with all of these mutant gangs running about and mutant creatures. So things will just get very deadly very quick, and they'll have to, I think, win some respect with the gangs so that they can help them out and then follow some rumours to get to some of these ancient devices or high-tech devices that they can use to help them. And then I think the twist is going to be that it will become very clear that... So they have just this group, they've taken the debt thing really seriously. Look, we need the money, we can't ask questions, we've got to do these jobs, we've got to get the cash. Every now and again I've implied that the job that they're doing is unsavory. They haven't minded very much. Well, it's going to be really in their face that the quest giver here caused this catastrophe. So all of the ruin and chaos that they're experiencing was deliberately caused so that this artifact could be created, and let them make the decision about whether they want to pay off their debt by returning the artifact, I'll offer them enough money to clear the debt, or whether they're going to, you know, make their situation even worse by effectively becoming outlaws by taking on this corporation. We'll see how it goes, but I'm quite excited to just pile on the carnage. It's the end of a run. I hope there'll be a little bit of character death, but also some opportunity for them really to, you know, to do some large scale exciting things. I can see them eventually leading these rogue, if they decide to go that route, leading these gangs against the corporation that brought them to ruin. By the time this goes out, I'll have already done it, and maybe I'll do a follow-up episode letting you know how it's gone. Yeah, so I did the Electric Bastion Land game. It was carnage. A few things I sort of learnt from the previous game. Had a lot less going on the map. Still, I'm kind of a hostage to that getting everything done in 3 hours rule that I've got. But this was a final session. So it had to be brought to some kind of a conclusion. And I had a few things up my sleeve. I had a whole bunch of things on the maps which the characters could use to be really badass. So I marked a thing on to be a hangar, which was full of mechs, which they could have used to fight all the big monsters that I put there. They avoided it. That's fine. So they didn't have the big mechs. And then I put in this whole, you know, these whole armies. They, in the end, they became, they were mutant creatures. One of the characters in the setting had been an animal test pilot, genetically engineered or not genetically or whatever. We were sort of a bit vague about that, but an engineered animal test pilot. And we established that he was coming home to the place of his creation. And I had a whole jungle full of mutant creatures for him to team up with. And I even was able to introduce them. But the characters took one look at them and turned around and went the other way. So exactly what they were, you know, because I thought that would be quite easy for, it's Spencer Freethrall, for him to have got in with them. You know, they had the same origins, but the players saw them, didn't want to go near them. So they were going to have potentially a mutant army. They weren't interested. They didn't go that way. So they fought. They didn't die. They fought a gigantic worm Xeno. It took a lot of their strength, you know, blasted everyone's hit protection, took a bit of strength, but it didn't kill them. So that was quite a cool fight against a big horrible creature. But then at the end, yeah, that, I mean, they saw the twist coming. Once they'd got the artifact, they were going to get whacked. They saw it coming, but then kind of felt a bit powerless when it was all happening, because they hadn't got tooled up with the mechs, they hadn't got these detachment of mutants. I was quite impressed with what they came up with. So basically they hid from this gunship as it came to wipe them out, and then there were these tense negotiations with the mercenaries that clearly had orders to whack them once they got the item. I mean, there are other things they could have done. They'd contained this item, they could have decided to uncontain it, which would have caused all kinds of chaos. But in the end, they managed to gain control of the gunship and crash it and actually win the final fight, really against the odds. So that was quite satisfying. One character went down in that fight, went to zero strength, so died in that fight. Yeah, I only had three for the last session, but that was two out of three survived. But then, of course, they still had the artifact, and so they decided they wanted to renegotiate to return the artifact and get paid. And I couldn't see a good way out of that. You know, the company that had hired them had tried to take the artifact and whack them. I couldn't see them then going about things a different way. But then I remembered I'd always had in mind, I mean, one of the things I introduced was that their ship, we've been calling the ship the Bastion, that's the link to Electric Bastion Land with my sci-fi game. We'd established that the ship, as well as Freethrall's character coming home, the ship had also come home because they'd been hired by the company that built the ship. And we established that This was all in character creation. It was all on the random tables that Spencer's animal test pilot character, when he'd escaped, he'd also stolen the ship. One of the things the company had offered was that they'd clean up the ship. They'd turn a blind eye to this stolen ship. So not only would the group have all of their debt paid off, but they'd also have the ship and be free and clear with that. So I'd established that the company had access to the ship. And I was always going to use that as a possibility, you know, that they could just blow up the ship because they could commandeer its controls or exploit something embedded in the programming or something like that. So I thought, well, that's what's going to happen here. They're going to go, yeah, we'll go along with that. Yep, you will agree for you to hide the thing. We'll pay up, and then you can tell us where it is. And the characters played it straight, but I had in mind that they would then detonate the ship. And there were clues to them being able to do that. And in fact, one of the players said, "Oh, we better check. They can't track the ship." It was there. It was in the discussion, but it didn't. You know, they didn't go, "Oh, be careful about our ship." So I did it. That's why I'm doing this debrief. I'm thinking, was this all right? I kind of thought, well, that's quite neat. You know, it's the end of the session. Actually, as part of their negotiation, they'd negotiated for the dead character to be basically not cloned, but to have their brain emulated so they could take them away as an AI and put them inside a synth body. So really, they'd found a way of resurrecting the other character. So there'd been no character death, really. So I said, yeah, so we just narrated that final negotiation. Well done, you get paid double. And then I described the final twist, which was that they'd used this exploit hidden in the program of the ship to blow up the ship. And I made everyone do a luck roll, an Electric Bastion Land luck roll, to see what happened in the explosion. On 4+, they'd be free and clear. They got out of the way. They weren't on the ship. On a 2 and 3, I was going to say there was going to be lasting damage from the explosion. And on a 1, they would be killed in the explosion. One player rolled a 1. Is that fair? I don't know. As I look at it now, it seemed really neat. You know, I'd always had in mind that they had this control over the ship. We'd always said it was an end of, you know, we were drawing things to a close in that session. It just, to me, it seemed neat to have this final peril, this twist. You know, I like that in movies where they pull the rug out from under you just at the last. But I don't know, the players like that. Did that feel a bit cruel to them, maybe, at the last, to have one player killed in that explosion? But it seemed to me like I had to establish some kind of cost for the negotiations going the way they did, because I thought, just why would the company just say, all right, yeah, you can have it? I don't know what people think. I don't even know if that's clear. I don't even know when I listen to this in the morning whether I'll play it. But I suppose I'm having second thoughts. Maybe I'm beginning to be racked by guilt about what I did at the end of that session. I don't know. So I'm still reflecting on this one, still picking it over. My general sort of dissatisfaction with the sci-fi game. I mean, so I was playing Electric Bastion Land, rules as written, but not setting as given. I've talked a little bit about that, talked about it on The Worm. Just didn't like the aesthetic, actually. Didn't like the feel of the setting. It's got a kind of sort of 1920s type thing going. Well, not even really that. I mean, there's lots of art deco going on in the book, lots of 1920s type art, but you've got everything. You've got space travel, you've got mechs out when you travel out of Bastion. It would be fine to have sort of medieval tech villages, you know. That's the idea. It's a kitchen sink setting with plenty of weird things that aren't really drawing on any kind of 1920s idea or aesthetic. And I'm not going to retread why I don't particularly like that setting. I wouldn't be averse to running it, to playing in it, but I wanted to do something different. I wanted to do this sci-fi game, but I don't know. You know, it's not. I wonder what it would be like. I think I can pin down the issue. So because I was trying to play it loose, I was trying to imply the science fiction in terms of references. You know, we've played a bit of Borderlands, we've all seen Aliens, you know, we know some of the Warhammer 40,000 stuff. So I was sort of suggesting all of that in the background. But we never really pinned down the kinds of things that were available to characters to do regarding the technology. So they never really had a full sense, I think I'm pinning it down. They never had a full sense of their agency, which I think is a real problem for this kind of game. Now, I think in Electric Basiland, if you're going to play it sort of full-on weird, which the you know, both Into the Odd and the Electric Basiland book do, then I think you have to put all the weird stuff into the oddities. You know, these oddities can do some weird things, but when you acquire the oddity, you know what it can do, and that gives you special powers. But even then, I'm not sure that helps when you're playing this setting where anything could be around the corner. It doesn't give the players a clear sense of their agency. What I mean in terms of my game was, for example, this exploding ship. You know, what did the players feel that their characters had the abilities to do? You know, given that everything's off the attributes, you've got no defined abilities. So did they feel that it was the kind of thing they could do to, you know, delve into the ship's computer and perhaps locate some kind of, sleeping problem? Did they feel that they could do that, or did they feel that kind of technical activity was beyond the reach of player characters? And that, to establish that, you know, when you've got a go-to genre, it's very easy. When you're all crawling around the dungeon, you know what you can do, you know what you can try and climb, you know what you can try and lift, you've got a sense of that. But when you're doing a sort of loosely defined sci-fi setting, I mean, of course they can ask the GM. They can ask the conductor, as we call them, Electric Basiland. I wasn't calling myself a conductor, but they can ask the GM, ask the referee. But I suppose we were spending a lot of the game doing that, spending a lot of the game trying to flesh out what the technical capacities were, what the specific technologies looked like. So I think that's where it becomes, you know, it crosses over from being an issue I had with fleshing out my setting into a real sort of game problem, that I'm just not sure if at any given time the players had a confident view of the kind of range and scope of activities, particularly regarding the technology, which we kept loose, that was available to their characters. Now, if you're playing a Star Trek game, you know what the Star Trek technobabble sounds like. You've seen all the episodes, you know the kinds of things they can attempt. You know that actually in the episodes, sometimes they attempt things which in other episodes they say, no, that's completely impossible, we can't do that, so let's do this. But, you know, you can cover that in a nice creative use of the skills. What if I try this? Let's leave it to the dice. And I suppose that's where it would go in Electric Basiland. Can I try this? Let's leave it to the dice. And I did make heavy use of the D6 luck roll, which I think is really nice. You know, anything that's not a save. Because remember, in Electric Basiland, you only use your attributes for saves. So if you're in peril, if you're in danger, you can save against it. That's when you roll your ability checks. Things which aren't really working like that, you roll your luck roll. You just roll a D6. If you get 4+, it pretty much goes as well as it could. If you get 2 or 3, it you get some of what you want, or it goes with a complication. And if you get 1, something bad happens. So one of the ways that plays out is in the when you're doing rolling for encounters. You know, 4+, you're free and clear, no encounter. 2 and 3, you get a clue or an indication of an encounter that might be about to happen. And on 1, you get an encounter. I think that's really nice. And then there are loads of example tables in the book. That's a really nice mechanic in Electric Basiland. We made a lot of use of that. So we could have done that. I've talked about that on the show before. You know, when they ask questions, what's possible in the tech, I suppose we could have given it to the luck roll. But I think that's part of, I'm pinning down one of the issues with why Basiland didn't seem to be working like my other games in my sci-fi setting. I think it's because the players didn't have that clear sense of the kinds of activities that were available to them in relation to the technology. Now, of course, that not knowing can be a feature. It doesn't need to be a hindrance, but it should be a feature when you want it to be. So I'm thinking I've got a bit more patience. I've got limited patience when I'm playing a fantasy game for people saying, yeah, but how far can you fall? How high can you climb? What really is, what poundage is within the range of a human carrying capacity? Because I just think with that, you know, we know. We've got enough of an idea for the narrative to go on. I don't want to spend time thrashing that out. But I suppose you've got license to be a little bit more anal. You need to be a little bit more particular with sci-fi games, because although we know, we've got a general sense of the kind of wall that can be climbed by an exceptional human or the kind of weight that can be lifted, we haven't got an idea of what else can be powered from a ship's hyperdrive. You know, so that would seem to be the kind of thing, and once you start fleshing out that kind of thing for your setting, you've got to say, where does it end, really? Now, you could say, well, the magic is all weird in a fantasy game. You've got to determine some of the bounds, but I tend not to. I tend to say, well, if it's your class abilities, fine. You know what it can do. It's there for you on the table. But everything else, well, let's just make it unique and strange. Now, anything magical should give that sense of, oh, I don't really know what his capacities are. I don't really know, you know, what the scope is of my interaction with this item or this monster. And that's what I always want in my fantasy games, when the magic turns up. But in my sci-fi game, when the science fiction is commonplace, the technology is in the background, seems like you would have to spend some time thrashing it out. Yeah, that's an interesting difference. Probably why I find it much easier to improvise my fantasy games, because, you know, I want the magic to be unsettling and weird, the fantastical elements. I want the players to be mystified by them, poke them, not really know what they're doing with them. That's the whole point of it being there. But your own ship, you don't want that to be a mystery to you. You know, the Millennium Falcon is not a mystery to Han Solo.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to contact Dave, please leave a message on Anchor, email dpercentile@gmail.com, or find him on Twitter at d_percentile.